cycling podcast Femina in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, brought to you by Skoda. Dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with, for this first cycling podcast Femina After Dark, Rose Manley.
Cue the jazz.
Hello.
Rose the Wolf.
Sorry,
Manley.
The
wolf girl Manley.
I've been around Quickstep too long.
And Orla.
What am I going to be?
Orla. Birthday girl Shenoui. Happy birthday, Orla.
Thank
birthday
you.
Girl.
That'll do.
The wolf and the birthday girl.
The wolf and the birthday. Yeah, that's better than what I had in mind.
So I mean, when I say after dark, I actually being literal there, it's dark.
Which you can't see on the podcast. That's you.
The nights are drawing in. The nights are drawing in. Well, Rose, you thought we'd never recorded in the dark before.
I mean,
We do have lights on.
Yeah, but I think it's normally like a morning or mid-afternoon. Mm. Thing.
Yeah, I'll be intrigued to see whether this is a different vibe.
What kind of effect it has on the podcast.
I'm feeling quite chilled.
Well, it's November, so it's time for the Cycling Podcast Femina for November. We're well into the off-season. Any news going on, Orla? What have you got for us this month?
There's
always
news.
Stuff
there's
going on.
News.
Before you do this, I should flag up what's coming up in this month's episode. We've got an interview with Lucy Kennedy, the Australian rider, who was pretty prominent at the World Championships in Innsbruck, and you met her recently. Rose, we'll hear from her. We'll hear from Audrey Cordon-Rigaud, the French rider who I spoke to at the World Championships, and she's always been a very interesting person to speak to. She's moving to Trek Segafredo next year. We will also hear from Isabel Best, who's written a book called Queens of Pain, which is a really fantastic book, looking at some of the legends and rebels of women's cycling. But before any of that, Orla, the news roundup, please.
All right, then. Not much racing to round up on, obviously, because we're now into the off-season. But since we last podcasted, I've made that into a verb, we have had a race. We had the final Women's World Tour race, the Tour of Guangxi. And it was... You're looking confused. We didn't mention that in the last one, did we?
No, we can't.
I always do like this.
Oh, right. Just your natural state. Cuban sprinter Arlena Sierra won that for Astana women's team ahead of Hannah Barnes for Canyon SRAM and Sarah Mustonen. We've mentioned Arlena before in the podcast. She has the most fascinating backstory. Cuban sprinter, comes from really humble beginnings. She grew up in her grandparents' home. Her parents and siblings all shared the one room, and cycling was her way out of that life, really. There's a brilliant article, I think it's on Develo CC, about her, her whole history. It's definitely worth a read. It's great to see her taking the final World Tour win of the season. In other news, of which there is plenty, we have the former Dutch road race and time trial champion, Lois Groenewijk, will be the national coach of the Dutch national women's team from the start of 2019, and it's the first time that they've had a separate women's coach. Did we know that?
Yeah,
interesting, really, isn't it? And that they haven't actually had that before, given the prominence and dominance of that team. So we'll be looking a little bit more, I think, in the next few months at Dutch women's cycling, just because of a personal interest, why not? But, you know, is that a new direction for them? We shall see. Annemiek van Vleuten is backpedaling again following surgery to replace the knee fracture that she had during the World Championships. That came in the road race. Of course, she was the time trial champion at the World. So she's back on her bike. The European Cycling Union has announced plans to include the new mixed team time trial relay in next year's European Championships. So, of course, this comes off the back of the World Championships announcing that they're going to have the inaugural mixed team time trial relay in Yorkshire next year. So Europeans are getting in on the game as well. well, and I guess that's going to be a bit of a test event really ahead of the Worlds. On branding sponsorship news, the New Zealand bike brand Chapter 2 have announced that they will be replacing Cervelo as the equipment sponsor for Cervelo Bigla from 2019. Bigla will be the main naming rights partner for that team. The UCI president, David Lepartien, has suggested that ASO is working on adding a women's Paris-Roubaix to the calendar as soon as 2020. This got a lot of traction in the media. I don't think it's the first time that it's been suggested.
You said it on the podcast in July.
Oh, did we?
He did.
Oh, he did?
He mentioned the women's Paris-Roubaix.
Oh, I think he mentioned it as a vague thing amongst lots of other things, but now he's talking about it being from 2020, so it's getting a bit more, he's polishing the idea a little bit. Yeah, exactly. On the subject of ASO, basically, La Course route has been announced for next year. And off the back of a couple of exciting years in the mountains, it's more of a puncher's race, really, in Po. We've gone from two stages a few years ago back down to one last year, and it's staying at one. And it's on the circuit of the men's time trial. So it's laps of a time trial circuit. I mean, I can tell by the faces staring back at me now, there is very little excitement.
Lumpy. You know, it could be a good race.
Well, this is it. And to be fair, you know, we have said a few times on different La Course race courses when they've been announced that it didn't look very exciting on paper, and we've had fantastic racing. So you just never know with this kind of thing.
But it's so odd, isn't it, that La Course, it's like it doesn't have its own flavour. You can't go to it every year and say, it's not like Liège-Bastogne-Liège or something where you know what you're getting. La Course could be anything. And I just think that's
so good. The Tour de France, though, you know, and the course changes every year.
Positive as well, can't it?
But I think it's trying to be like the World Championships. Yeah, we can expect that changes every year. But I mean, when there's so few mountains on the women's calendar as it is, and kind of looking back at this year, we were kind of like the Giro Rosa was great for mountains, and La Course was great for the mountains, and there was nothing else in that. It just seems so odd to have another punctures race.
Yeah,
I just don't think that. It's kind of lazy.
Looking forward to playing this back when we have an absolutely thrilling best race ever.
I also do think that we often in cycling fall into the trap of thinking that mountain stages are the holy grail and that everything has to be. And I do know that in women's cycling, we have a dearth of hilly, hard racing. But I don't think it always has to be that way. And on a one-day race, anything can happen. So
yeah, but
I'm trying to be a bit positive.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's why I stopped talking. No, I do want to say, before this gets played back to me in the future, I'm not saying it's not going to be a thrilling race. I'm not saying that the riders aren't going to make the most of it.
There you are.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that I just think with a race, it needs to have some expectations. Some identity, that's exactly right. It needs to have some identity, and that's obviously not what they're trying to do with this. And when we had that stunning race this year, with Van Vleuten and Van der Breggen, I thought surely this is going to be a great template to be like, right, that is our identity.
Yeah.
We do big mountains, a one-day race, which is huge mountains, and it's really exciting. And they obviously haven't even taken that into consideration. They just thought, where would it be easy to put up a load of rides? Where are there lots of hotels? Oh, Po. Yeah, there's
But you know, that
there
has to be a consideration as well. The logistics do have to be a factor, and we can't discount that. But Lepartien is now, again, going back to what he's been talking about in the media, talking about maybe now the possibility of a 10-day women's Tour de France, and that could be an option for the foreseeable future. Quite how or why or whether he's speaking on behalf of ASO in this matter is unknown. But that seems to be what he's talking about. But as ever, we need detail on that. But just to finish the news roundup, on team news, Brian Cookson has been forced to put a hold on his plans to launch a women's team in 2019 due to a lack of financial resources. He said that their hunt for a main financial backer has proven to be the biggest obstacle, and the earliest likely date to launch a team would now be 2020. He says it's not put to one side indefinitely, but that it's proving more difficult than he first expected. And on that note as well, we've had a crowdfunding exercise which has been launched by Bob Varney, the head of the Trek Drops team, as it has been until, well, as it was this year. Their title sponsor, who they were due to announce, we understand, shortly, after the Worlds, wasn't it?
I believe it was going to maybe even be this week they were going to announce that, because they were possibly going to announce it on the podcast.
Oh.
But yeah, apparently pulled out at the last minute and they're fighting for survival. Mm. They seem confident that they will carry on in some way, shape or form. But whether that's a scaled down operation. Yeah.
Whenever they were on the way up, you know, they're emerging, they're becoming more and more professional and they were doing better and better things, that it may be that, yeah, they can survive, but on a shoestring and with a much reduced roster of riders, that would be a shame. And it's the flip side, really, of the bigger sponsors coming in, because obviously Trek are now starting their own team instead of sponsoring drops. And there are two sides to the coin, of course, of when we're talking about minimum wage and whether or not that can be afforded by enough teams in the peloton. You know, we don't want the gap between the haves and the have-nots in women's cycling to grow.
They have a new bike sponsor. They do have a bike sponsor, but, you know, it's a bit like what happened with the Cannondale Drapac team last year, threatened with extinction. Same scenario when a sponsor pulled out at the last minute, launched a crowdfunding appeal, and from the publicity that came with that, contact was made with Education First, who took over the title sponsorship. Bob told me the other day that he's had, you know, that conversations have been had on the back of this appeal that they've launched, and that's kind of, that seems to me to be a more realistic proposition than raising
crowdfunding the crowdfunding itself.
But the crowdfunding is almost a means to an end, perhaps. Mm. One other bit of news, Orla, that you might miss, because we've had a pretty frantic day, and you've had a birthday and a surprise visit from your mother.
Too much cake to fit in. Yes, my mum flew over to London to surprise me this morning.
And so that means you've not been paying as much attention to the news today as you should have been on a day that we're recording the Cycle Podcast Femina. But we can excuse that. But
that's very graceful
the UCI,
of you. Thank you.
Are to introduce a new maternity clause to contracts from 2020, which will coincide with the launch of the Women's World Tour teams. Initially, five teams will be Women's World Tour, paying a minimum salary of, it's believed, €15,000 initially. Maternity leave clause, which is included in the self-employed standard contract, will allow women to take 3 months leave on 100% of their salary, followed by an additional 5 months at 50% of their salary. And Orla, you thought that was, when I mentioned that earlier, you think that's a big step forward?
It's a massive step forward. And especially when you look at the landscape of women's sport in general, maternity is a big issue. And most sports do not offer any kind of maternity support. But that, in terms of a maternity package, is actually really, really favourable as well. And you have to caveat that with how much money the women are actually getting. But I mean, I'm in a really, really good package where I work. I get 6 months full pay. And then after that, it's statutory pay, which is massively reduced. To have 3 months full pay is brilliant. But to have the following 5 months on 50% is really, really good, actually. They're very, very, very favourable terms, you know, in terms of job support and everything. So I think that is great, yeah.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our headline sponsor. Quite a few people from Rafa in our audience last night at the Clapham Grand. We're recovering today from our annual show, Cycling Podcast and Friends, plus Amaraterra, the band who do our music at the Giro. Orla and Rose, you both had roles and you were both on stage. Enjoy the night.
It was absolutely brilliant. I love it. I love the atmosphere at those kinds of shows. It's wonderful when you get people who actually take time out to come and spend time with you and discuss cycling. You know, it's such a lovely, warm atmosphere and people come armed with questions. And the problem is always that you never get through enough of the questions, you know, compared to what is on offer. It was just brilliant. It was a lovely atmosphere. Having the music was brilliant. It was great to have the whole podcast gang together. I had a ball. I loved it.
Rose, as a new member of the team, relatively speaking, it was your first cycling podcast show. We are hoping to do some cycling podcast Femina shows as well next year. That's the plan. Did you enjoy it last night?
It was excellent. And actually, returning to my old stomping ground of the Clapham Grand as well.
The last time you were there, you were saying, you were mentioning.
Last time I was there, I threw up on my own shoes.
Shoes you wore last night, though.
They were very
smart.
They were very shiny. Yeah, it could possibly be. But it's very hard to, like, get through a crowd quickly when they're dancing to, like, call me Al or something and try and get to the toilet. So yeah, I was
call
spying.
Me Al. Is that what usually rings out in there? Well,
yeah, it's kind
call
of
me getting, Al.
Yeah,
Jesus, how old are you?
This
is the sort of thing I come out with.
It's those kind of cheesy classics at the Clapham Grand. So
I yeah, would have been a classier to... party chick than that, Rose.
Oh God,
to revise
no.
my
no,
opinion.
I don't think on no, what I've heard, not. I mean,
not
it's
nice.
All like sticky carpets for me. Mm. If we could do our next show in Infernos, that would be even better.
Down
on the
road,
disco.
I spotted that. That was the only place that was still open, actually. When
that
we
was. It was
there.
A fantastic venue, though. Really yeah. Grand by name, grand by nature.
Oh,
it did
was.
Feel
beautiful.
Very special to be in there and have a full
royal
house
boxes and everything.
Oh, it was wonderful. Mm. Well, Rafa, as I mentioned earlier, our headline sponsors, they were obviously supping Prosecco in
they
the
were
Royal
in
Box.
Good
couldn't,
voice as well,
couldn't
weren't
quite
they?
Extend to champagne, but you know, it's the end of the year. We will be talking later about a new book that's been published by Rafa, The Queens of Pain by Isabel Best. It's a wonderful book. Make a great Christmas present if you're looking. But Rose, you said, Orla, there hasn't been a lot of racing, but Rose, you are back from a race in Taiwan.
Yeah, a race of kind. Well, it's not like
a race of sorts.
Certified thing, but yeah, it's quite, I think people will start to hear about it. It's called the Taiwan KOM and it is a monster race. It's like 105 kilometers and it goes from sea level, so 0 meters on the coast, and you see the sunrise, and then you just climb and climb and climb and climb up to 3,275 meters. It is.
That is bonkers.
It's bonkers.
Just
yeah,
like cycling up a wall.
It's ridiculous. And then, and also, like the worst bit of it is, like the last couple of kilometers where the gradient goes up to like 27%. It's mad. It's absolutely mad. Like I was tired and I was on a motorbike, but so I don't know what everyone else was
trying
feeling.
To hang on to the front of it.
Yeah. So there was a few pros there. Hayley Simmons was there, and Lucy Kennedy was there. Lucy Kennedy actually won the event in like some, you know, insane time. I mean, she's a slightly older rider, although, yeah, when I say that, I mean, she's actually only 30, but she's come to the sport quite late. So she's only been a pro, this is her first pro year. And she's had a bit of a tough year. She's made some really promising performances, like she helped Amanda Spratt to get silver at the World Champs. But she actually said to me that she, looking back on the year, every race she'd been to, she either crashed in it or it rained. She literally, there wasn't a race where neither of those things happened. So a kind of a year which has been quite tough, but with some real highlights. But I spoke to her at breakfast after the Taiwan KOM, and this is what she said. Lucy, tell us about what your highlights of your first season have been. Because it's been a bit up and down, isn't it? Or a lot of downs.
Yeah, a lot of down in the middle part of the season. It started really well, actually. The very start of the season went far beyond my expectations, Strada Bianchi and a couple of other races, and then everything turned upside down, and basically several months just revolved around crashes, really, and coming back from crashes and crashing again. But yeah, salvaged something from the season, and ended up really well with Worlds and then coming here.
Was there a different feeling when you were lining up like at Strada Bianchi or in Australia last year as a pro rider? Did you have a different feeling than you had the year before when you had been doing big races but not as a pro?
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's more, there's probably more pressure and more expectation on you, and everyone, you know, when you're with the national team, people kind of look down on people on national teams. It's almost like they don't deserve to be there. So when you're there in a kit of one of the best teams in the world, there's a bit more respect and more, yeah, expectation on you.
And tell us a bit about your journey to becoming a pro, because you kind of joined the sport late.
Yeah, so I've really only been racing a bike for a few years, having come from running and having a lot of injuries, and sort of found myself on a bike, and one thing led to another, and here I am as a professional. Yeah, not something, even 5 years ago, if you'd said I was going to be a professional cyclist spending my time in Europe, I would have laughed. So it's been quite a quick journey to get here, but a really interesting one.
And have you been able to enjoy it? I mean, it's kind of the coming together of a dream of being a pro athlete, but then again, it kind of comes with its own challenges, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's strange. Like, ever since I was a kid, all I ever really wanted to be was an athlete. And the sport has changed many times. Running was not my first sport. I was a tennis player and a sailor and a swimmer and all sorts of things. But really, like, that's what I remember from my childhood, is playing sport and really wanting to be one of the best in the world at whatever it is I was doing at the time. So it's really, it's a little bit strange to be here. But yeah, I just feel like it's living my dream, basically.
And do you feel there's actually a bit of a benefit to joining the sport late? I mean, a lot of the pros do join, they definitely join later than the men do, and some of them come from like banking and PhDs, and you were a traffic modeller, is that the term? I don't really know what that is.
Yeah, so I'm an engineer and sort of found my way into this niche area of traffic modelling. But yeah, I think having, there are pros and cons to coming into it later. I mean, obviously, you know, the girls that have been riding bikes since they were little kids, their bikes are basically extensions of themselves, and they, you know, they handle their bikes really well, and it's just second nature to them. I don't have that at all. So the challenge for me is the technical side of things and the skills. But in a way, I wish I'd gotten into it sooner. But on the other hand, I've done a lot of other things in my life that I wouldn't change. And I think even now I'm better set up for post-cycling as well. Having now had 5 years working as an engineer, I don't feel like I'll have any trouble slotting back into that if that's what I want to do. Yeah, so it's just a different way of doing it, a bit backwards.
Does it feel a bit kind of like you go from being like full-time with a normal job, and then you come into this environment where kind of people wash your clothes for you and book your hotels and sort your flights out? Is that a bit weird? Or?
Yeah, definitely a bit weird. Yeah, it's been a big change in lifestyle, for sure. And I still when I hand my washing bag over to this one to do my washing, it feels a bit weird. And it's amazing how when you go from working 40 hours a week, 40, 50 hours a week, and fitting in 20 hours of training, to going, all I have to do is ride my bike. But it's still amazing how little time you feel like you have. You fill up a day. Yeah.
And now what's next for you? Can you finally stop cycling this season?
Yeah, I am going to have a little bit of time off. I mean, I did have a little bit of downtime straight after Worlds, and then the last couple of weeks I've only been sort of semi-training. So it's been, while I've still been riding, it definitely hasn't been the same stress and pressure on it. And I'll have a little bit of time completely off now, and then start getting back into it, because we have Nationals in January in Australia, so there's not a whole lot of time to stop.
And at the moment you're kind of, you've already come in as like a super domestique already, helping Spratty to silver at the World Champs, but do you have your own ambitions to be a leader, and when does that start being put in place?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly when, but yeah, I think physically I'm capable of, you know, really mixing it with the best riders in the world in some of these hard races. But I think it'll just be a progression that'll happen naturally when it does. Like, I love riding for people like Spratty and Annemiek, who, you know, they're just the best riders in the world and just such nice people as well. That I love riding for them as well. So I'm sure I'll get my opportunities when they arise as well.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet there, the voice of Race Radio, of course, at the Tour de France, who was with us at the Clapham Grand last night, which was nice, yeah. Introducing us all.
Called all the women charms.
Yeah, the charm of the podcast.
And Francois Thomazeau.
Yeah, that's true. Did say, before introducing me, you won't understand her accent, but please do try for her behalf.
He doesn't really speak like that, as we just heard. The reason we just heard his voice is to remind me to tell you that this month's episode sponsor of the cycling podcast, Femina, is The Economist again. Now, we're going to talk about an article that's in a recent edition of The Economist in a moment, but The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, arts, and even sport. The Economist helps readers prepare for what's going on in the world around them, and in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. For over 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter most. And we normally, as I said, pick out an article. It was an in-depth feature in a recent edition of The Economist on the issue of transgender rights, and a bit in the article about how they apply to sport. It's a very pertinent issue at the moment in cycling, because recently a transgender athlete, Rachel McKinnon, won a world title, world masters sprint title, I believe, wasn't it, Rose?
Yeah, on the track, that is. So that's for people who are aged 35 to 44.
And it got a lot of publicity, generated a bit of controversy, because the bronze medalist initially complained that this was unfair, and that sparked quite a controversy. She later apologised for those remarks, but the subject is covered in great depth in The Economist. And it's very, very interesting, because there are two different movements, I suppose, in the UK and the US at the moment. In the UK, there is a consultation about giving transgender people the right to self-identify without going through the psychological evaluation or living in their preferred gender role for 2 years, as is currently the case. In the US, quite a different scenario there, with the Trump administration seeking to assert that trans people have no legal right in federal law to define their gender as different from their biological sex. If they're born a man or a woman, they must remain man or woman for the rest of their lives. And this has obviously been perceived by a lot of people as an attack on transgender rights. As I mentioned, this was really covered in a lot of depth in The Economist, and we felt it was, since it's something we've been asked about as well, actually, on social media, as it relates to women's cycling, because it's a big issue in women's sport. But should it be, is one of the questions that we'll maybe hear one person's answer to in a moment. But before we get on to that, I should tell you how you get a free copy of The Economist. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. To get your free copy, just text BIKES to 78070. Text BIKES to 78070 and you can get a free copy of The Economist. But we felt, since it was very good timing that The Economist has chosen to tackle this subject and to really look in some depth at the whole issue of where the law comes into play, you know, the state's role in this issue. And also, as I mentioned, they do mention sport and how it applies to sport, because stories like the Rachel McKinnon story throw it into sharp focus as it applies to sport. Are we going to have a scenario where, well, it boils down to fairness, doesn't it? As we've seen in the Rachel McKinnon story.
Well, that's the debate boils down to, but it boils down to rules, really. As with everything, you can have an opinion on what you think and whether it's fair or not, but if she's allowed to compete, she's allowed to compete. If she's not and the rules are changed, then she's not. But yeah, I mean, the question is it a question of fairness or is it a question of just following black and white?
Well, that's what's so interesting as well, is that the transgender issue is not an issue that is coming up all the time in women's sport. And yet, like, Natalie Van Gogh is a transgender athlete who races on the road. I think she was at Park Hotel Valkenburg last year, and she's got a contract the next year, but forgive me, I can't remember where she's got a contract. So the idea that a transgender athlete can compete doesn't seem to spark any of this social media fury, but then when a transgender athlete wins something...
Well, that's a very good point,
yeah,
indeed.
So it's like a difference between, oh yeah, it's fine for you to participate, but then if you actually want to win, then it turns into a bit of a monster, doesn't it?
But that's what I mean. We can say it's a question of fairness, but it's not. It is a question of rules. And it's only when they win that we talk about fairness. Yeah. But
the rules
allowed,
are designed to ensure fairness. And I think the rules are still catching up with...
Are they? Or are they designed to create certainty?
I think they're designed to
there's a lot of unfair rules.
To try and create a level playing field. But, you know, can I just read a bit from the Economist article on this? The article says the third place cyclist, that was Jennifer Wagner, complained that male puberty permanently boosts muscle and creates a bigger frame, heart and lungs. She backed down after she, you know, got a lot of abuse on social media in particular. And Rachel McKinnon made this very point that when trans women win, it's unfair. When we lose, no one notices. And she's made the point as well that, you know, she competes in a lot of races and doesn't win. And it's only when she won this title that it was suddenly an issue. On the subject of sport and how this applies in sport, several American states, says the article, have used self-ID for youth events for some years. Gold and silver in this year's 100-meter girls' state championships in Connecticut went to natal males. In recent weeks, swimming competitions in America and university athletics in Canada have switched to self-ID. In 2016, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, stopped requiring athletes to have undergone gender reassignment surgery and cross-sex hormone treatment before competing as a member of the opposite sex. Now it requires male athletes who compete as women only to lower their testosterone levels. Other authorities, such as USA Swimming, let males compete without any hormonal or surgical treatment.
So that's what I mean when I say that rules aren't necessarily designed for fairness. You've just got to follow them because they create certainty. You know, when you look at athletics, for example, Caster Semenya, born as and identifies as a woman, but she is forced to lower her testosterone levels. Now, is that fair? I mean, I wouldn't say it is.
I'm not saying that it is fair. I'm saying the rules are designed to try and create a fair competition. That doesn't mean that they are fair. And certainly the case of Casa Semenya is hugely complicated. And there is overlap here in the debate around transgender athletes and in the rules about testosterone levels in female athletes. And as it happens, I recently was in India very briefly. This seems like a strange segue, but bear with me here. I was in India at a sports literature festival. That's too much of a segue.
Not too much. Yeah. Well, not mention the bath. Go on.
But I was there with... I was there speaking at a sports literature festival in southern India, and somebody else who was there was a former middle distance runner called Madeline Pape, an Australian who competed at the Beijing Olympics and at the Berlin World Championship. She actually ran against Casa Semenya and complained afterwards that it was unfair for her to compete against Casa Semenya. But she is now a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the US, and this has become her special subject. She was there talking about the testosterone rules. She's very interested in transgender athletes as well, and in this whole subject. And I found what she said absolutely fascinating. So I turned the recorder on, and I thought she'd be a really interesting and important voice to have on the Cycling Podcast Femina. I should say she also has competed in bike races as well. She became her running career was cut short. She took up cycling for a bit. She's beaten Corn Rivera in a couple of races in the US, she told me. So promising cyclist at one point as well. But I'd say a real world expert on this topic.
I should explain before we listen to this interview that Madeline and I were speaking in the back of a taxi in India after visiting the Konark Sun Temple in Odisha. Hence the background noise and the occasional honking horn. The odd pause can be explained by the fact that it was at times quite a sketchy journey.
I'd like to know about your own personal experience, because you raced against Casa Semenya, didn't you, 2009?
Yeah.
And am I right in thinking that you initially were sort of quite annoyed that the unfairness of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how much I actually thought through it all. I think I was mostly kind of being influenced by what people around me were saying, and there was only really one perspective being represented, and that was that she shouldn't be there, and she wasn't as much of a woman as the other competitors, and that was, there really wasn't any other kind of information being given to us or any other perspective. So I think in some ways I was actually pretty ignorant at that time, and the sport was very ignorant. I think a lot has changed since then because of Casa Semenya, actually, because people have followed her journey. But at that time, it was a very kind of, it was a very vicious environment, actually. Very, very cruel, vicious. People saying very denigrating things towards her. No one being held to account for that. You could say whatever you wanted about this woman, and no one was gonna stop you.
What was the journey that you went on then to, well, challenge some of the views that you had then? And what's your view now?
Yeah, so after that event, after 2009, I didn't really ever reflect on that moment. It came, it went, it seemed to be resolved because the IAAF brought in new rules, and I never thought too much about it until I ended up in graduate school in the US and did some courses that were like feminist theory courses for the first time. And actually the very first book we read was about this topic, about excluding women who have differences of sexual development. And it was the first time I had encountered both the fact that there is a critique of these kinds of policies, but also it was the first time I had seen a really careful analysis of the kind of science that governing bodies like the IAAF rely on, and the first time that I realised that there were actually some really important critiques to be made of the kind of scientific knowledge that the IAAF was relying on. So that was a really kind of like a mind-blowing thing to discover, and it challenged some very deeply held beliefs, I think, for me. And so it was actually very difficult to have people around me at that time challenge me to accept an athlete like Casa Semenya. That was, for me, very confronting. And I didn't immediately change my mind. It took a lot of time and a lot of reflection, a lot of reading up on both the scientific and the ethical criticisms of these rules. And I think actually what was really important was having friends with naturally elevated testosterone, and also having friends who identify as transgender. They, I think, were really what brought it home to me that what my position is now, which is that if I recognise someone as a woman outside of sport, then I'm not going to impose a double standard and say that the rules are different inside of sport. You know, my friends who I see as women outside of sport, I also now welcome as women inside of sport.
I suppose at the heart of it, though, when it, as it relates to sport, is fairness and as level a playing field as you can achieve, which is almost an impossible thing to, you know, it's an ideal, the level playing field, but we all have biological differences, and you know that's part of sport too. But what does it mean for sport? Because there are different arguments raging in the US and the UK about what it, I guess, what it means to be a woman as well, and how who should be recognised as a woman, and whether an individual has the power to identify as a woman themselves. These are all hugely, well, they're big questions for society, but they're also big questions for sport. How do you think sport should wrestle with this?
Well, I mean, it's really polarizing, actually. I think that it's a situation a bit like, to me, it feels a little bit like the in the US where the Democrats and the Republicans won't speak to each other. I think because it touches on such anxieties for people, or because it provokes such anxieties in people, we haven't really had a very open conversation about it. And people haven't really, at least from what I've seen, sat down and thought carefully about what it would mean to welcome transgender women, for example. Here I'm talking about more sort of like athletes and coaches, people who maybe are more on the front line. Maybe it just hits too close to home or something, but we haven't been able to have those conversations, which I think is necessary. So at the moment, it's more kind of, I think, a lot of fear and people committing to certain views without necessarily seeking out any further information. And that is being encouraged in a lot of ways by the example being set by governing bodies like the IAAF, who are certainly not going out of their way to promote dialogue. But I think in terms of sport wrestling with this issue, that it's like crucial that we get to a point where people can actually have open and comfortable and well-informed conversations about what we're really talking about here, what the options are regulation-wise, what is at stake in terms of people's lives and rights to be recognised, as well as rights to participate and so on, what health implications are at stake here. I think there are a lot of questions that it would be great to see sports like track and field actually get to a point of being able to discuss in a measured and respectful and informed way.
We've had obviously a case in cycling of a transgender athlete winning a gold medal in the World Championship, and that has sparked a debate.
I think a lot of this is conjecture, right? Because we don't know what the situation is going to look like a decade from now or 5 years from now, when perhaps because of social changes we do see more transgender women coming into sport. At the moment, there's a lot of fear and I think a lot of speculation about what might happen, what that's going to look like for women's sport. But I don't think it's actually... I mean, we have these sort of isolated examples of transgender women and also women with high testosterone experiencing success, but they're isolated examples. So, I mean, I think that's why I sort of come back to the need to make people... to work towards making people more comfortable with this topic and more informed and better able to relate to and recognise the experiences of women who are not cisgender, women who have high testosterone. At the moment, I think there isn't a great deal of understanding or sensitivity towards who these people are as people, and instead there's a lot of speculation about what might happen to sport and so on, and discussions about fairness and words that are pretty, you know, loaded terms in sport. I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's a search for a desire to find a scientific answer to this, almost to take the human dimension out of it and make it objective.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, is that achievable? Can we objectively, scientifically say, you know, this is a woman and this is a man?
Right. I mean, I think people forget who is producing the science, which is humans. So there's no way to avoid the human dimension. And the way that the IAAF and the IOC have, like, doggedly pursued certain research agendas has to be recognised, I think, because we don't have the same support being put into alternative scientific agendas, which reveal the issues with the way that the IAAF are trying to scientifically justify their rules. So, yeah, coming back to whether scientifically we can draw the line, I think that's what people would like to be able to do, because it feels like it takes the politics out of it. It feels like it's concrete, reliable, objective, and therefore no one has had to be put in the situation of making a tough decision. But science in this situation has for the last 70 years, actually, is it 70 since basically the 50s, so maybe it's like 60 years, it's continued to fall short when it comes to this project of trying to draw a clean line around the female athlete category. And I don't think that's going to change, because ultimately that line is going to always be grey, and science isn't going to give us a clear answer on how we might police that line.
And testosterone is the hormone that we measure in order to... That currently seems to be... The debate centres on testosterone levels.
Yeah.
And you were saying a minute or two ago that that is kind of flawed thinking as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. So people are very... Well, this is, you know, speaking from my research, and I've interviewed a good number of elite athletes and coaches in track and field, and many of them are very committed to testosterone as the key factor that matters to athletic ability, and that explains average differences in performance by men and women. Very, very invested in that idea. But when you put to them that, athletic ability is, well, being a successful athlete is a lot more complicated than testosterone levels, right? And you give examples such as the fact that there are women who are competing at the elite level whose bodies are not responsive to the testosterone in their blood, meaning they derive no advantage from it, but they're competing at the elite level. And there are also male athletes who have testosterone levels in what is considered to be the normal female range, and they are competing at the world championships level. There are outliers of this kind in the sport of track and field, which shows that it couldn't be only testosterone that is determining what's happening here. And I think people, when they think through it logically, they see that and they acknowledge that, but then they very quickly kind of switch back into this mode of being committed to testosterone, because it's very hard, I think, to disinvest in that once you've poured a lot of belief and emotional investment in this idea over a long period of time, as an elite athlete would, from the moment that they're a young athlete and you're learning these things up to when they're competing at the elite level.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast Femina. You can get 20% off your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. And we're very grateful to all our supporters. And Science in Sport have been supporting the cycling podcast Femina from day one. So thank you very much indeed to them. If you go and, stock up on your science and sports supplies. You do help support the podcast as well. Now, very interesting to hear from Madeline Pape on the topic we were discussing in the last part. But we've got a couple of other interviews to fit in this month, bumper month of interviews, really. Audrey Cordon-Rigaud, I always find her really fascinating. She's very outspoken, says what she thinks. First time I met her was at a Wiggle High Five team launch a few years ago in Ghent, and we went out for a team dinner. And she was very interesting on some of the issues that they were facing as female cyclists in terms of pay and so on. And really putting me on the spot and challenging me and asking me, how much do you think we earn? In that very direct French way.
Did you guess?
I can't remember. I sort of pled ignorance, I think, and she didn't ever tell me, but I guess it was very low.
You just got up and went to the toilet and never came back.
I never came back. I was scared. But she's great. You know, I remember at the women's tour this year as well, when she was in a break all day with Cecilia Utrup-Ludwig and was very, very angry when she got back to the bus, because Utrup-Ludwig had, according to Audrey, she'd made a promise to drop back after the sprint and hadn't done so, and kind of spoiled her chance of staying out. That was a great day's racing, actually. Mm-hmm. In the end, it was a day where nothing much happened in the race, and it ended up as a bunch sprint, I seem to recall.
Yeah, it was the day that Didrikson won, I think.
I think you're right. Emilie Didrikson won the sprint.
In Worcester.
In Worcester it was, yeah. But
I literally looked this up because of the event yesterday.
It was a great day.
Researched your stage performance.
It was a great day's racing. And as I say, Audrey Cordon-Rigaud, very, you know, not shy at all about telling you exactly what's happened and what she thinks. So at the World Championships Innsbruck, I thought I'd speak to her because she has been a stalwart of the Wiggle High Five team. She's moving on to Trek Segafredo. I wanted to speak to her about Wiggle and what happened there. She said some really interesting things about that and about what she expects with her new team, Trek Segafredo.
I can see it right now. We have a lot of medias coming for the men, but none of them is knowing me, actually. I can tell you that the journalist from L'Equipe, with the newspaper, the most famous in France, was there and he didn't know who I was. In France it's still super slow, but I saw some improvement. But we've been fighting a lot for that.
That's interesting, though, because the serious point there is, you know, I remember in L'Equipe the day after La Course, you know, there was very little. There was as much about Pauline Ferrand-Prevot not finishing the race as there was about the race. Can you see any progress there? And ASO as well, you feel ASO could do a lot more to, you know, really make a difference in terms of promoting good events for women. Why is there this? Because in the UK and in certain other countries, there's a totally different attitude. Why is it different in France? Is it just because of the history of cycling is much deeper and that women's cycling is not really part of that history, or what is it?
Yeah, I think basically in France it's all about Tour de France, and Tour de France is for men, so there is no space for women. It's been a hard time for the past generations with the presence of Jeannie Longo, who took the wall space on the medias and on the majors in general, because she was one of the famous, and she's still one of the famous sports women in France, that she's not racing anymore. Eh? So it's really massive. So she just put the others on the shadow, and still now, I mean, in the nationals, you can hear people screaming her name when she's not even in the bunch. So yeah, it's been, and the Tour de France and Jeannie Longo have been putting so much shadow on women cycling in France, that I think this is the only reason why we still suffer from the lack of media. But it's growing. We have also a special media for women now who are growing, and we have people like me who just don't want to shut up anymore. And I think we need to be more, because I can't understand why, when I want to go to Chrono des Nations, I should get three times less than a guy who is not even top 10 on the national, you know? This is things that I want to fight for. This is not normal, not in 2019, almost. How you can accept that in France? Yeah, we still have so much to improve in France, particularly. But it's growing, and for sure the Tour de France is putting so much shadow on us, And ASO could do more, but we are not bankable. That's the reason why they don't invest in women's cycling. We are not bankable. They just do that to get a better picture of them. But this is the only reason, and they won't do anything more.
When you look at the progress that's been made, though, how important do you think your team, Wiggle High Five, has been in that? Because they were one of the first teams to come along. You joined them a few years into their existence, but you've been there for quite a while now. How important has that team been, and how sad do you feel at them disappearing?
I think it's really sad that this team disappeared, but at the same time, I think it was coming to the point that the other teams around were progressing so much more than us in terms of organization, in terms of scientific side as well, like the aero position, the material and stuff like this. And I think we missed a bit of this side, like talking a bit more with Colnago, for example, and working on the aero of our TT bikes, or I don't know, all those things around that we didn't do in the end make us being a bit less good than the others. And I'm not sure that that the team wanted to support this side of cycling. And the good side we've been really good on was the media side of what the picture we wanted to give from the team. And I think we had a super good image outside, and all the people I met were super surprised that the team were disappearing, because from the outside you can't imagine that it will stop because of the videos we are doing and the image we are giving. And we've been growing a lot women cycling in this part of the job, like really with the media and how to show the best picture of you, of yourself, the best profile.
And your new team, I mean, they seem to be building a team that's not just going to be competitive, but, you know, looks as good or if not better than all the other teams. I mean, how excited are you, and how difficult is it going to be to gel all these very different riders together? You've got Lizzie Deignan as well coming back. Do you know her well? And yeah, how do you look on, you know, stepping out with a team that looks like it's going to try and win an awful lot of very big races?
I think the key of this team is the two DS. The two DS, I think, are the best. They're coming from the same generation of cyclists. Okay, George has been racing until now, so probably we have some difficulties to see her as my DS, but I will, because I respect her so much as a person, as a rider. And Ina, she was just the one I was looking from my little place when I was super young, and she, I always been so respectful for her. And those two are able to make a team with anyone. They are able to make a team because they know what they want, and they know the project of Trek is just building a team as performant as the men. We will get the same as the men. They don't want to do any difference. They want to make us equal. And that's what I like. That's why I wanted to sign in this team, because they respect us as the men. They don't do any difference. And that's, I think, that's what every team should do.
You know, next year when you sort of embark on that season, what are the things you're most looking forward to? Are there particular races that you're looking forward to?
I want to continue having fun. I've been having fun for 5 years now. First with ITEC and then with Wiggle. And I don't want to lose this part of fun that women cycling still have, and that men cycling, I think, have a bit less than us. So having fun with my teammates, of course doing good races, being an attackant, maybe a bit more than what I've been until now, because of the tactic was in place, being at the front, playing the big role, and winning, because if you look at my palmarès, maybe I don't have so many wins, but I'm a winner. But definitely in my head, I'm a winner. I'm someone who likes to win, and I don't want to lose that anymore.
You're a Breton.
And I think it's hard to say when you're not from France, but every French people would say that if you're Breton, you have a hard character, and it's who I am. I'm coming from a country, a land where cycling is everything. So, yeah, I just want to win again. I just want to be part of a team who wants to win and who is professional and who is just giving everything to get results. And that's what I missed a bit the past years.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast Féminin, brought to you by Skoda. Dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Thank you very much to Skoda, who have been backing the Cycling Podcast Féminin since the women's tour, the heady days of the women's tour, all that intense
the heady, intense days.
Is that Skoda gone back yet, or...?
Oh, yeah, yeah, the score that's been returned, yeah, it was picked up.
Assuming that Lionel had put a little baby seat in the band.
I think he wanted to. He wanted to hold on to it, but it was picked up eventually. I hope we get another one next year. That would be nice. I'm in the market for a new car, Skoda. If you're listening, I really
subtly big, done, big Rich, fan of the class Karoq, with which he operates.
Big fan of really is done. They happy, picked up on the hint.
No.
Happy to drive around in a branded up car as well. You know, like 1980s footballers used to get Ford Capri,
or like the French from the local and Belgian and Dutch commentators and TV presenters at the Tour de France. They have their big faces on the side.
Yeah.
We should get our faces on the side of a Skoda.
I think we should get our bodies on the front of it. We've just been hit by the... Maybe that's not good for the Skoda image.
Maybe not the Skoda image.
Not a great look, but I'm happy to have my big face on one of the doors.
You take up a whole bonnet, that noggin.
Enough. Thanks, Skoda, though. Thanks very much.
That was really rude. I'm sorry. I'm going to blame the hormones.
Upset. Before that little interval, we heard from Audrey Cordon-Rigaud. Really interesting. I mean, you know, spoke about, I thought what she said about France and about her desire to promote women's cycling in France, the fact that the L'Equipe journalist wouldn't recognise her, I find staggering, given that she's been around for a while now. French national champion, she's current time trial champion, been around for several years, a leading rider.
And for us, she's like a go-to for an interview as well. Mm. An absolute
I'm
go-to.
Not surprised by that, though. I mean... I see it in mainstream cycling media here, if you can call cycling media mainstream. But, you know, even at La Course, I saw, you know, respected and esteemed colleagues who didn't know who Anna van der Breggen and Ashley Milne-Passio were. Unfortunately, that's still the state of affairs at the moment.
She was, they should speak to her because
absolutely.
She's really
interesting. Yeah, excuse that.
Very interesting on her
they
team.
They should know who she is.
Yeah, on the team Wiggle, high five, saying, you know, how they really fell behind in terms of equipment and some of their attention to performance details while always being ahead of the game in terms of the presentation, media image and so on. I thought that was interesting. And about the new team, Trek Segafredo with Giorgia Bronzini and Ina Tuttenberg, the DS is, she thinks, being key to that team's success. So, yeah, I don't know if she was flattered or not when I put it to her that she was becoming a kind of elder stateswoman. She's not that old, but she's quite a leading figure, quite, as I said, vocal, the Bernie Eisel of the women's peloton, I suggested. But, you know, she is sort of growing into that role, I think. She's one of the people who, certainly if there's a problem or if there's an issue, I can imagine that she's the sort who will vocalise that.
She reads a race very well, but I think that's also because, you know, you'll see her in breaks. And she's one of those, but I mean, I guess that's why she's also a go-to person to talk to, isn't she?
So that was Audrey Cordon-Rigaud, and we'll be speaking to her a lot more next year, I hope, and getting insights into her team. It's quite a mouth-watering prospect, isn't it, next year? Because you think about, you know, we've had a season dominated by the two Dutch riders in particular, Anna van der Breggen and Annemiek van Vleuten. But coming back, it seems like Lizzie Dagenham has been out for a long time. She's only been out for a year. But in that year, a lot of things seem to have changed. And these two have really moved on to a different level. Will Lizzie Dagenham be able to bridge that gap that seems to have opened up when she comes back? She'll be part of this very strong team. And I think it's looking really quite interesting.
Yes,
I'm really excited to see what Trek Segafredo bring to the game, actually, because I just get the feeling that they're bringing that level of professionalism and not just the title sponsorship. And it is largely, I mean, I've said it before, Audrey said it as well, largely because they've got Giorgia Bronzini and Ina Tuttenberg as DSs. I find that really, really exciting, and I find it's something new, it's something fresh, it's something that should be happening more in women's cycling, and I'm really intrigued to see how that's going to pan out. I think they hopefully will shake things up a little bit. And, you know, we've loved seeing Bols Dolmans dominate and, you know, well, you know, it's nice to see a level of professionalism that they've brought to women's cycling. But I will relish that being challenged a little bit.
Needs some competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, changing tack completely. I met Isabel Best recently. Isabel Best, a journalist and an author. And she has written this wonderful new book. It's a beautiful looking book. It's got great photographs in it and some absolutely wonderful stories about some of the real unknown, in a lot of cases, heroines of women's cycling. I mean, some of them are well known. There's obvious people like Beryl Burton, Jenny Longo is in there. Very interesting chapter on Jenny Longo, actually. Marion Martin, who won the first ever Women's Tour de France, Connie Carpenter Finney. Some of them will be quite well known, but an awful lot of really, well, unknown to me riders, and some really poignant stories as well about the hurdles that some of these riders had to overcome in order to sometimes even just ride their bikes, never mind compete. So really nice stories, and she met quite a few of these riders, or, you know, did some pretty deep research into their lives and into what things were like at the time that they were riding. So let's hear from her now, Isabel Best. Her book is Queens of Pain, and it's published by Rafa, and it is available, and I think would make a fantastic Christmas present. The book's broken into sort of chapters looking at various kind of female riders over the years. I mean, tell me how you made the selection. Did you drop a long list and then whittle it down, or was it, did these names just come through your reading about the sport in the various periods?
There was a long list of about 50 riders, I think. And I mean, I think I was quite similar to a lot of people that I've been talking to about it, who say, well, you know, we know about Beryl Burton and Alfonsina Strada and Eileen Sheridan, but there's a lot of riders here that we'd never heard about. It was a similar thing for me. I knew a little bit more than people because it's just something that interests me anyway. I've been wanting to do something on female cyclists for a while. Really, I had to sort of go in quite deep with the research, and I felt a bit like a detective. I had like a few clues sometimes, and then I'd have to like scratch around and see if there was something there or not. And sometimes, like Millie Robinson's story, for example, that, you know, I'd heard that she'd won what was billed as the first women's Tour de France in 1955, and that she'd broken the hour record. And Beryl Burton mentions her in her autobiography as this kind of really tough adversary at the beginning of her career, and they sort of battled it out for the BAR award, which Millie won. I just have to say, fighting Millie's patch, but. It was almost impossible to find anything else about her, and you know, I didn't even know if she was alive or not, and I just found it extraordinary that there was so little information on her. And so I had lots of things like that where I say I didn't have that much to go on. You know, like maybe like you sort of start off with Wikipedia, don't you, or you start off with a list of world champions. And I mean, I had a similar thing with the Russians. Like, I really wanted to include Eastern European riders in the story, and it was really hard. I mean, I don't speak Russian, so that obviously doesn't help. Anyway, so I got onto a local historian who gave me the email address of the daughter of one of these great champions, Lyubov Kocetova, who won the first ever women's world championship in the 3,000-metre pursuit in 1958. And her daughter had emigrated to Canada, so she spoke English, and it was just the most amazing thing. You know, from going from like despairing that I was going to have any Russians at all in this book, I finally had this incredible series of interviews over Skype with her daughter Marina, and she told me her mother's life history, and it was just breathtaking. It really was, you know. So like, we have all the, you know, cycling is full of these great stories of like suffering and like people with awful childhoods and like working in the coal mines and all this stuff, and like Lyubov's story is like, you know, that plus, you know, factor 10. So she grew up in Leningrad, lived through the siege of Leningrad, which if you read about it is just absolutely so horrifying and dark, and she survived that. And then she fell into cycling, became this brilliant champion who won, really sort of multi-talented, was very good at all sorts of different track disciplines. You know, not I mean, the sort of usual thing is that you specialise, and she just was very good at everything. And then she had this dreadful accident where she should have died, had terrible brain injuries. Anyway, she survived. She survived this. Not only did she survive it, but she came back and then went on to win the world championship. So it's just the most phenomenal story. And along with that, I was like told about the whole, what it was like to be a cyclist in Soviet Russia and what it was like to go to the World Championships, and they weren't allowed to talk to the other riders. So there was just like a huge divide. And she said, well, you know, Russia is a huge country. We don't speak any other languages. You know, we wouldn't have been able to say hello to anyone. It was just an amazing, extraordinary story.
And how did some of these riders... or indeed their family members react to being contacted and you know, ask for an interview?
Oh, that was just lovely. It was so much. I really felt like I won the lottery with this book, because it was such, there was so much goodwill in it. The writers were just really delighted to have their stories told, and you know, I think they were often celebrated at the time, but perhaps not enough. But they kind of had their degree of recognition. But you know, a lot of them have been forgotten. I mean, but you know, not completely, but you know, like, you know, Kitty Hacher, she has, there's a, you know, an annual award in her name, and you know, there's like, there's a sort of like cycling paths named after, you know, she's a very well respected in Holland, but even she was like really pleased that I wanted to talk to her. And you know, it's just, it was really lovely. One of the things that I was really thrilled about was one of the first people I contacted was the person, that was the great niece of Tilly Anderson, who's the rider in the first chapter, who was this brilliant champion of the 1890s in America. And the incredible thing about her is that there's this just staggering archive of race reports, and I think it was her husband. He subscribed to a newspaper cutting service, and he gathered all her cuttings and he pasted them into great big scrapbooks. And there's like four of them. There's just everything there, you know, and it's also got like little handwritten notes of hers and photographs, and it's just this incredible sort of time capsule. And her niece was just so thrilled that I got in touch with her, and I felt like I'd been the first person to speak to her, but actually she's been speaking to lots of people and everyone's like, oh, she's so great, isn't she, so lovely to talk to, and she's so helpful, but she's just so enthused, and she's so passionate about her great aunt's achievements, and she was a real sort of legend within their family and really celebrated within their family, and it's a very powerful character. So yeah,
I think you were saying earlier how unassuming a lot of these riders are. I mean, I interviewed Marion Martin a few years ago. She was the winner of the first ever Tour de France Féminin back in 1984, I think it was. And she's now a photographer in Colorado. And this, I think, when I spoke to her, it felt to her like a small chapter in her life rather than the central chapter in her life. Whereas for a lot of the male riders, their entire identity is wrapped around being a professional cyclist, being a champion. Was that your experience, that a lot of these riders, because it probably wasn't a professional career for them, they probably didn't earn a lot of money doing it, that it's almost just a footnote in their lives rather than the thing that they, you know, kind of have constructed their whole identity around?
I think it was really important for them. I think they were all really ambitious, even if they're kind of quite modest about it. I think it meant an awful lot to them. But at the same time, it was really rare for women to be able to make a living from racing. There's very few instances of it. And so they had to do other things at the same time, and they were like juggling all of that. I mean, they've all had very different lives. A lot of them didn't get married. Perhaps they weren't that way inclined. I know there are some that married very late, so after childbearing age, presumably because they just didn't want to have to be distracted by having, you know, like, you know, that would have been the end of their racing if they sort of started a family. But you know, and then there's quite a few who you know, they stopped racing and then settled down and had kids, and you know, just there was so much else going on in their lives at the same time. You know, they didn't have the luxury of being able to devote their lives to cycling. They couldn't really make a career of it in the sense that the men could. So inevitably they were involved in lots of different things. But you know, Kitty Hacher, actually, to come back to her, I was asking her, you know, was it difficult after you retired? And she said, well, I had my family straight after that. And I just didn't have the black hole, because I had my first child, and it was just I went straight into other things. And, you know, she says, life is more about more than just racing anyway. And I think it's maybe, you know, it gave them a healthy perspective on that as well, that, you know, maybe it's not a blessing to be able to devote yourself full time to it. Maybe it's actually a curse, you know, because you become so sucked into it. And so many riders suffer from depression, don't they, when they retire, because they just, it's this kind of huge vacuum that they fall into. So I think, you know, perhaps that was quite good for them, for their mental well-being, and maybe it means that they're kind of just more all-rounded people in later life.
Do you it might be Kochetova, but do you have a favourite story or character from the book?
It's funny, actually, each rider, as I was writing her chapter, thinking, oh, this one's my favourite. I don't know. I mean, Tilly Anderson, I just love her story. Margaret Wilson, she was just like incredibly beautiful, but didn't seem to be spoiled by it. Very witty. She wrote, she would write articles and had these very droll stories that she would tell about her adventures. She clearly really enjoyed racing, and it was a social thing. You know, she was part of the Bournemouth Arrow Cycling Club, which was a male and female club, one of the rare clubs at the time that allowed women. I've seen pictures of their club rides, and they just looked like they had so much fun. And so I love her story, and she was such a brilliant rider, but also a bit scatty. And she rode on this sort of steel frame. Well, it was an obvious steel frame at the time, but you know, I think she had mud guards quite often when she was doing these time trials. And she would ride to the race with a tent on her bike, and would camp at the race start, and would sort of rely on people to wake her up before the race began. You know, really slapdash. and yet would like do these blinding time trials and later set records. So I loved her story.
So that was Isabel Best on her book Queens of Pain, and got it here. It's a nice looking book,
isn't
lovely.
It? You're hogging it, actually.
I'm hogging it. Do you want to borrow it, Rose?
Oh, yes.
I don't mean like on a permanent basis.
Just for 30 seconds while we finish the podcast.
I
make
us
look clear, generous, then take it back
hold
again.
It for a bit, but it's
thank you.
Nice, but
like you do with children.
I thought
hold it, but give it back. Don't put any.
Isabel Best was fascinating on the process that she'd been through to write the book and to find out these stories and in terms, you know, how she selected the writers that she wrote about. So yeah, that was interesting. Shall we wrap things up there, ladies? We've got another dinner tonight, haven't we? It never stops.
We're just luscious.
How spoiled do you sound?
Off-season
oh,
activity.
Oh, the partying and the fun will not end.
I don't know if I can,
it,
I don't know if I can face it.
I've got no room between this growing thing inside me and squished lungs. But I'll try to wolf down a lot.
You've already ordered your courses.
I know I have. I'm going to have to now. Yeah.
What have you ordered? Can you remember?
I do remember. Yeah. I had lobster risotto.
Oh, fancy! That was the expensive thing, wasn't it?
It wasn't the most expensive because I thought, oh, are they gonna think I'm taking the mick?
Well, they did.
They will now. And the sea bass for mine. What have you gone for, Rose?
Scallops and pork.
Oh yeah, pork 10 ways.
Pork 10 ways.
Two ways, I think.
Richard, what
two
are you having?
This is scintillating, isn't
if
it?
If anyone is still there, thanks for listening.
By the time you listen to this meal.
Still, if you're still out there.
This meal will have been digested. I'm
we'll
having
update on it the next
scallops and
scallops.
Trio of lamb, trio of Welsh lamb.
Oh, I was choosing between that and anyway.
In honour of Geraint Thomas. Anyway, that's all for now. We'll be back next month. Thank you very much, Rose.
Thanks, Richard, and happy birthday, Orla.
Oh, thank you. You're going to sing me out?
We should sing you out.
Yeah, I can't remember the rights issues over happy birthday.
Oh, you're so mean. Come on.
Okay, go on then. On the count of three,
Rose.
One, two, three.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you.
I'm going to shed a tear.
Happy birthday, dear Orla. Happy birthday to you.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.